views expressed on this program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of this station, its management, or other advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.
Welcome to Executives After Hours, real conversations with real leaders. This is your host, Dr. James Kelly. I want to make you a promise that over the next 60 minutes, you will learn at a minimum two things. One, every leader and executive makes mistakes on the way to the top. And two, and more importantly, everyone has a unique story to tell. And that's what we do here on Executive After Hours. We sit down with leaders across a variety of industries, and we talk to them about their unique story. So welcome to the community, and stay tuned for today's episode on your Executives After Hours. Hello, everybody. Welcome to this week's episode of Executives After Hours. This is your host, Dr. James Kelly. To those checking this out for the very first time, I say thank you so much for your time and energy. On today's episode, I have the pleasure to interview Mr. Jeff Gibberts. Jeff is the president and founder of True Voice Media, as well as the host of Shareables. You can find his podcast over on the C-Suite Network and all the other major outlets. And ironically, Jeff and I both are publishing each other's interviews. So once you get done listening to this fantastic hour-long dialogue with Jeff, you can flip on over to Shareables and listen to the half-hour dialogue that Jeff and I had about the intersection of technology and life. Besides that, you can also then subscribe to both, which helps us both out, and write a review on both. So it's like double whammy week for you here on Executives After Hours. I always want to say thank you to my community and steadfast listeners. Without you, I would be sucking completely. So stay tuned this week. Again, it's Jeff Gibberts. Leave a review on iTunes. Check out C-Suite Radio. It's a host of other topics on that site. All right, see you. Thanks again. And, you know, for my audience, you know, you've got a couple different hats. So what I always like to try to do with people who aren't like the Jeffrey Hazelitz of the world, if you could just give me the quick 10,000 foot view of what you're up to and what you're in charge of besides your own life, that would be outstanding.
Cool. So what I'm probably most known for is that I have an Etsy store where I make custom capes for infants. And on the side, I also have a social media and content marketing agency that I've been running since 2011, where we focus almost exclusively on building brand awareness, generating leads, and closing more sales. Though we do dabble in internal collaboration, HR and recruiting, and all sorts of cool things like that. I've also got a podcast called Shareable, which is on C-Suite Radio, and it is totally kick-ass. We just hit number 4 on Overcast today, even though we only launched about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago. So pretty stoked about that.
And what's the premise of it?
Of Shareable, it's a podcast about people and technology and how those are two universal forces that impact our lives. And I really just pick people's brains and listen to their stories about how people about the people that have had profound impacts on their lives. So somebody that was there at the right time in the right place and said just the right thing, and it forever altered the trajectory of that person's life. And the technologies that opened up opportunities that could have never otherwise been available. And I'm fascinated by how those two things impact different people. By the way, the Etsy store thing was a lie. That's not real.
It was like two truths and one lie. I should have started with that. That's actually a great segment, by the way.
That is good. Yeah, we should probably work that in. That's good.
So fantastic. Now, I know you're based in Philadelphia, and I actually just moved from Philadelphia, so we'll probably talk a little bit of Philadelphia here. Where do you live in Philly?
I spend all of my time at my girlfriend's place, which is at 15th and Arch, and it's also closer to both of our offices. So I pretty much just hang out here, and we're going to move in together somewhere in this area, somewhere in Center City.
Fantastic. Now, are you born and bred in Philadelphia?
I'm not born nor bred in Philadelphia, but I moved here, and actually I call last year my equinox year, because it was the year in which I was going from spending as much time in New York as, or in Philly as I did in New York. So I spent the first 18 years of my life in New York, moved to Philly for school, and I basically just stuck around. And as it was my 36th year in life, it was my equinox year, where I had been in Philly just as long as I was in New York. And at the turn of the new year, I officially became a Philadelphian.
Do you ever wonder, I mean, obviously growing up in New York, were you in Manhattan or around Manhattan or on the outskirts of Manhattan?
I begrudgingly will admit that I was born in Long Island, but my saving grace is I hate the suburbs, always have, always will. And I got out of there as soon as I could, and I moved to whatever city would take me, and that was Philadelphia, because that's where I was in school.
So did you have any inclination or desire to go live in Manhattan after you finished? Because you went to Temple.
Oh, God, like every day of my life.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, my God. You grew up in Long Island, and like New York is like the center of the universe to you. So and I romanticized it like, you know, like Walt Whitman would the outdoors or things like that. I look at New York, and it, to me, it's a beautiful thing. But it's not, you know, it's not what it was when I grew up. I feel like now to live in New York, you have to be like a gajillionaire. And if I was a gajillionaire, I probably would move to New York, but I'm not a gajillionaire, so I live in Philly. I think about it all the time. I totally want to move back.
Well, I think what's fascinating is that, you know, I've lived in a bunch of big cities. I mean, I've lived in Philadelphia. I say New York, but I was on Staten Island, which doesn't really count, but it is part of the boroughs. So I live on Staten Island, Chicago, San Jose, San Francisco, Tokyo, and now I'm just.
You lived in Tokyo?
Yeah. And
that's awesome. I went to Tokyo for 6 weeks. It was awesome.
It's an amazing experience. Like, I mean, it's, you know, it's funny when I try to describe to people about the magnitude of noise and action going on at all times in all areas, it's really tough. And I used to describe it as Times Square. And then I would say it's Times Square, but every train station around the city is Times Square. So
yeah, that's actually exactly how I describe it. I say it's like, imagine if there were five Times Squares, like you go to Roppongi or Shibuya or any of those other places. Yeah. And it's like, oh, just like time. Yep. There's another one. Yeah, it's massive.
It's insane. I mean, it literally is insane. And, I'd like to go back again at some point. I've gone back once since I lived there with my wife and my then 1-year-old kid, which is kind of hard to enjoy it, but we made it work. We'd put him in the stroller and go out drinking. That sounds awful, by the way, but not like club drinking, but like go get some food and have some drinks. So not like go get boozed and stumble home, just so people know. I'm not that bad a parent. It was great. And I'd love to go back again with my other kids so they can experience it, because I just think that it's such a unique city. I mean, there's just something about it that you can't explain. I mean, what were you there for? Just vacation?
No, I actually went there in my early years. It was a study abroad when I was at Temple University. I went there for an art program. It was 6 weeks in Tokyo. We did like a weekend trip to Kyoto. And so, yeah, I was there for school. I was like 21 at the time, maybe 20. I don't remember. Anyway, it was something like that. It was like I was like 20 something, early 20s.
And what do you remember most about it?
Honestly, this is going to sound like just totally stupid, but ramen noodles, because I was in
college.
They're
amazing there.
That's the thing though. Before that experience, I was like, and this was before ramen was like a thing in the US. So like ramen noodles were those crappy little top ramen packages you would get. And I would eat the hell out of them as a college student because it's cheap. And then I got to Japan and I saw these places that serve ramen. And I was like, so why am I going to pay like $8 or $9, whatever it was in yen, to get a bowl of ramen? And I ate a bowl of ramen. And like, I feel like my life was changed. Like at that moment, I was like, a whole new world. Yeah. It was amazing to me. So I would say ramen was one of the big ones. The other was, when I really think back at the whole experience, I was shocked by how safe I felt at all times, anywhere, at any place in Tokyo. It was like, it didn't matter where I could walk down any alleyway, and I never even considered that it might be dangerous because it just felt so safe. The onsens and the sentos, you know, the public baths, which are not a part of American culture, were so incredibly relaxing and, you know, just like profoundly relaxing experiences. Overall, I just found that the culture was so different yet the same. It was like, what if people in Western cultures were really, really nice and respectful? It would feel like Tokyo. You
know? So it's funny because talk about safety. I remember one time I went out and I missed the last train. And for a city that is so big, trains stopped running around midnight. And I missed it. And taxis were ridiculously expensive. And I didn't have much money. And to get back to my flat that I was staying in would have cost me probably $100 to $200. I mean, it would have cost me a ton. And so by the time I got to the train station, like 1:32, and the first train was at 5. And I thought, well, I think I'm just going to sleep on the streets. So I literally walked around, found a staircase, curled up in a ball underneath the staircase, and slept for 4 hours on the street. To the point you made, because I knew how safe it was. Like, I had no...
Yeah, you were like, and you took out your money and made that into a pillow because you knew that nobody would take your money.
And that is exactly what happened. And then the other thing that I always try to describe to people, which I forget sometimes, but as you talked about the onsens, is that I belong to a gym. And typically in a gym, the cleaners of the men's restroom are going to be men that come in while you're getting changed or whatever. Not there. It's women. Women come in, they clean while you're cleaning. Men are naked walking around. Women are cleaning the floor, like wiping things down. And all you have is just cock everywhere. And I just think to myself, how weird should that be? Like, if you're her, I mean, she was probably in her 60s. I mean, she wasn't like, you know, she was some like really attractive woman. She was sweet. I would say hi to her, but I felt so weird being around her in the men's restroom. But like in that culture, whatever, like didn't matter. So it's just like a weird, yeah, there was just those peculiarities that kind of stuck out in my head. So
yeah, now, yeah, things were just a little different.
Yeah, so now, what made you decide to go to Temple? I mean, cause obviously from Long Island.
Yeah, so I was not a great student. I wasn't a bad student. So I'm not going to like, you know, I was all D's or F's. No, I mean, like, I just kind of was like, I just know I need to get through this thing. But that also doesn't open up a tremendous number of opportunities. And that's not to say that, I'm upset that I went to Temple. I thought Temple was a great school, but I only applied to like 5 schools. So I applied to NYU, Temple, and then like 4 other programs. I was looking for film programs because I was a film major. I wanted to become the world's next Stanley Kubrick, but first Jeff Gibbard. And basically I didn't get into NYU, which was my first choice, and Temple was my second choice. Mm-hmm. So I just went to Temple.
Growing up though in Long Island, like, do you have brothers and sisters?
No, only child, but I was a child divorced, so I had the steps. So I had 2 stepbrothers out on the eastern end of Long Island, and I had a stepbrother and a stepsister from my mom's second marriage, but they didn't live with us or anything. But so I had some steps, but nothing. I am an only child. I command everyone's attention, and I do not like to share.
It's a redeeming quality. I think you should hold on to that.
It works for me on stage, maybe not in all areas of life, but when I get on stage, it's a pretty nice thing.
Yeah, no, it makes sense in that environment. So like as you go through school and you matriculate and you get out and you do your thing, like what did you do once you finished at Temple?
I waited a lot of tables and bartended and bar backed and like tried to. That's part of kind of an ongoing narrative, which I'll give you like the 45-second version of. When I was 13, I wanted to be the starting point guard for the Knicks. When I was 16 or 17, I wanted to be the world's next Stanley Kubrick. At 20-something, I wanted to travel around the world and take photos for the swimsuit edition of Sports Illustrated or Maxim or GQ, because obviously an early 20s guy wants to take pictures of half-naked ladies. After that, when that didn't work out, I decided I wanted to start a personal chef service. And after that didn't work out, I decided to go get my business degree from Drexel. So it's basically just been this constant struggle and just going after things that I'm passionate about. I was like, okay, I'm interested in this. And that's what I went after. And every time that it failed, I pivoted and went to the next thing. And it's everything's kind of built upon it to get to where I am today, which I think is actually, I'm really happy for all of the quote unquote mistakes or missteps or failures that I had along the way, because they got me here.
So do you think that because I can relate to that 100%, by the way. Why do you think that you were chasing all of these dangly, shiny things on the side? Like, are you an instant gratification type of person?
No, I'm a big endeavor type person. So I didn't say that I just want to play college basketball. No, I want to be a starting guard for the Knicks. P.S. I'm 5'5". So very, very, very low likelihood of this happening.
That's being generous as well when you say low likelihood.
Yeah. So that, right. And then I was like, okay, I don't just want to make movies or cute documentary. No, I want to be the next Dan Kubrick. I want to go down in the annals of history.
So and even like the in. Basketball like thing. Every time you're all in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I did a podcast with John Nastor of Hack the Entrepreneur, and he does this thing where he tries to he talks to entrepreneurs and he tries to find their thing. And the episode title is Why You Should Go All In on Your Next Project, because essentially that's my thing. I go all in on whatever the hell it is, and that's it. And that's how I quit smoking. When I decided to quit smoking, I was like, I no longer smoke. It's sort of this all or nothing that I do with pretty much everything. I'm either interested and I'm passionately, wildly, obsessively interested, or I am completely disinterested and I could care less.
So what happens when you care less? What happens when that flips, when that switch flips?
I mean, it depends on what it is, but generally I just, for some things, in my business, I outsource that function. I find someone who actually is as interested in that thing, which surprises the hell out of me. But I find for instance, the guy who looks at my finances, Joe from my team, he looks at my P&L, he builds out balance sheets and income statements. And every week we have a call and he just gives me the high level of it, because it's not why I do what I do. I hope to obtain some measure of wealth at some point throughout my life, but that's not my interest. It's not why I do what I do. He likes to look at that stuff. He's interested in putting it together. He likes to look for the trends and numbers. That bores the shit out of me. So I just let him do that, and he gets excited about it, and he watches over it, and I get to do what I do. So that's kind of how I function in business with it.
Yeah, but I guess I still kind of go back to, though, and again, I relate to this, so I'm not saying there's no value judgment whatsoever. I just am thinking through my experience, and at some point, there's something else going on, right? So I tend to go all in on many things that I do as well. It's harder as you multiply the children factor. I got to be honest, because there's a different a different set of pressures that happen.
I heard that.
Yeah, and so, but I am a big believer about doing things that make you happy, excited, passionate. You just can't always do that. At least that's my finding. Is there's always going to be something on the fringes that you're like, oh, this is bullshit. I hate it. And I try to outsource as much as I can outsource as well. So again, I can appreciate that. But I always have to wonder, have you found that it thing yet? Or do you think you're still finding it, looking for it?
What, the it thing that really jazzes me?
Yeah, for a longer period of time. I kind of feel like you'll know it when you know it. I guess that being said, I thought I'd
know it before. Oh, definitely. So. I literally think everything that I've done has been that thing. I think what happened was that I recognized when it wasn't going to work and I pivoted. So I went all in until I hit a point where I was like, okay, I've – in going through that process of being all in, I've reached a point where this is either something I'm no longer interested in. I've worked that out through the process of being all in, or I've realized that the odds are stacked against me and I need to do something. So for instance, I started a personal chef service back in 2002. I had it for 2 or 3 years and I really loved it. I love cooking. It's a passion of mine. There were certain aspects of the job that I didn't love, but I really enjoyed doing it overall. And again, I wanted to revolutionize in-home fine dining. That was it was a big idea again.
So but when I came to the realization, what aspect did you not like?
So I realized it was really more that I realized that I was lacking in a skill, and the skill was that I could cook my ass off and I could track to a certain extent food cost, but I didn't understand the entirety of what it was to run a business. So I thought, okay, if I'm going to do this, I need to understand how business works. And I decided to go and get an MBA. But I went to get my MBA specifically so I could come out and restart my personal chef service. But because of timing, because of other interests that I have, I found that as I was in my MBA, social media was becoming a thing that I was particularly interested in to begin with. I love people. I love technology. And I decided that that was a more suitable place for me and a place where I felt I had a competitive advantage relative to the personal chef service, which felt to me to be, while disruptive, the technological infrastructure that exists today that would make that a profitable career potentially, I don't think existed back then. Mm-hmm. And I saw social media as the sort of situation where everybody was at the same starting line at the point that I was considering going into it. So it really gave me the sense of opportunity to just work harder than everybody else. And if I did that, I felt that I could get a step ahead of them if I just committed to it and I stayed in for the long haul. So that's why I did it.
And
I guess the point is I just ran into limitations.
Yeah. Well, and I always think that, like, I was having this conversation with somebody and there's always this point of commitment. And are you committed blindly or are you committed consciously? And the difference to me is blindly, you don't know when to step away, and consciously you do. And it sounds like when I'm listening to your story about personal chef is that you realize that consciously, if I spend any more time on this, I'm wasting my time. Like, it's not beneficial for my end goal, right?
It just wasn't working. It didn't catch. You know, like I wasn't getting traction. And I think that's probably one of the other things that I look for is like, is this getting traction? Mm-hmm. So if you can see forward progress, then it makes sense. Then you have to kind of assess the situation and say, is it enough forward progress? Is it progress that's moving, I guess, forward in the correct direction? But if you're not getting traction, you know, if you're just kind of like, you know, treading water a little bit, then it doesn't really make sense because businesses are designed to grow and we weren't growing. We were kind of treading water. It was kind of a side gig. I couldn't really turn it into the thing. So I knew that I had to adjust course. So I did. And in the course of adjusting course, I came upon a new course that felt like a better course to take.
Well, and that's always a sign that it wasn't your calling, right? Because if it's someone's calling, typically, is that if there's a tiny roadblock, you either go through it or around it. And for you, you weren't passionate enough about it to be like, I'm dedicated for life. You're like, all right, I gave it a good go. I learned all these skill sets. Let's use that on the next venture that I do. And that's an entrepreneur. I mean, that's a serial entrepreneur at the end of the day. Is I learned all this. Okay, that one worked. Okay, this one didn't. Let's move on. Next one, this one worked. That one didn't. Okay, great. Let's move on. So as you get out of that, right, and you go to Drexel University and get your MBA. So as you pivot, when did you start True Voice Media?
I started True Voice Media in 2011, and that was actually the function of it was like such a happy accident, I guess you could call it. I had been working for a management consulting firm for 2 years, and I left there to go to a PR firm. And I was at the PR firm. It was in 2010 through 2011 as the director of the social media practice group. Now, at that time, social media was still, from a business perspective, in its infancy. And still, it's not matured yet. It's kind of an understood thing that's needed, but still doesn't get its seat at the table. But at that time, it was like your entire job being in that was to educate the customer about why they need it in the first place, five times more than you have to today. I had a woman back then ask me, what's a Facebook? And I was like, you have to be kidding me. But point being is that I was working for them for about 11 months, 10 months, something like that, 11 months. And, you know, we just came to a point where the practice group was not taking off. So they called me into the office, said that they were parting ways with us, with me. And I collected up my shit and got in a cab with my monitor on my lap, tail between my legs, trying to figure out what was going to happen next. Like, you know, do I go and try and find a job somewhere else? What do I do? And I get a call from a client that I had had. I only, you know, had a handful of clients over there, but one that called me and said, hey, I'm coming with you. And I was like, well, I'm going home, so I don't know what you're talking about. And he's like, well, I talked with them already and I'm coming with you. So wherever you go, I'm going. And that was the start of my company. I went home. I was married at the time, and I talked to my ex-wife and wife at the time, and I said, hey, I got fired, and I don't know what I'm going to do, but I have a client. She was like, well, maybe it's time you start your business because I know you've always wanted to. So I went out for brunch that weekend, and we sat around, came up with a name for the company. I bought the domain. I got all the social sites, and True Voice Media was born that next Monday. And I went out and I started grinding, and I fell head over heels in love with it within couple days. I mean, and it was a struggle. Don't get me wrong. Like, the first year was a shit show.
Yeah.
But it was the most delightfully glorious shit show of my career.
Is that just because you had total control of what you wanted to do when you wanted to do it?
Yeah. I'm not built to work for someone else. And I say that knowing that there's a possibility in every entrepreneur's life that you're going to have to work for somebody else at some point again.
So you've done this True Voice Media now since 2011. And
yeah.
Where do you think it's heading?
I'm actually taking the weekend to think about that very question. And I think about it all the time. I had drinks with a partner last night. One of my web developer partners, actually two of my web developer partners, just talking about business. And, I think there's a constant need to be assessing your business and thinking about where it's going and what you're doing. And, we haven't updated our website in a year, at least fully updated it. So I'm going to be doing that. But most importantly is, trying to think of, the Gretzky quote, where's the puck going to be? Skate to where the puck's going to be instead of where it is. It's that thinking because I'm so deep in what I do that I have to step back and sometimes consider where people actually are, where behavior's heading, where are the trends pointing to. Because when I got involved with social media back in 2008, I saw the huge opportunity for it to be a democratizing force to change the way we interacted with each other, to share our vulnerable side and be more human and understanding with one another. And, in some small pockets, things like that are happening. But I think more and more I'm seeing just
isolation.
Shittiness.
Just isolation.
It's just awful.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's arguing over nonsense. It's toxic, vitriolic conversations. It's mean-spirited people. It's, fake information flying around. Like, it's just a shit show. So now and not only that, but that's just kind of the normal person experience. And now I'm thinking about it from, I coach businesses on how to do this. I design strategies for them to get what they want. So I kind of have to step back and take stock of like, well, what's actually happening right now? Because the social media of yesteryear is not the social media of today. And I have to advise these businesses and even in good conscience say things to them that I know to be true or that I believe to be true so that I have integrity in the positioning that I'm giving them. So where is it going? I mean, I think one thing that's been proven to me, to myself at least since the beginning, is that I will roll with the punches and I will be fine. I almost lost my business last year because a dickhead client decided to just walk out and not pay his bills and for no damn good reason. In fact, we did everything we said we would do. The scope of work was, we were literally going through it step by step. Everything that was not done, we were waiting on them for. It was just a shitty situation. And I thought I was going out of business. It was just a big swing of money. And I came back and I basically said, well, screw it. I'm going to save my company. And I did what had to be done. I cut back on staff. I cut back on overhead. I went, balls to the wall out to try and get myself new clients. I booked 9 clients in 8 weeks. And I realized that, I'll be fine. I'll be able to keep working for myself probably my entire life. Now, will I generate the kind of wealth if I had went and worked for somebody else? Probably not. I know right now I could go out in the free market and apply for a CMO job or even director of marketing or VP of marketing in some, individual company, potentially an agency, and probably pull easily somewhere in the high 6 figures. But to me, that's losing. So where it's going is I'm going to do everything I can to keep this thing afloat. But where I really want to take my career with this is that I'm trying to get myself out of being in the day-to-day operations of my business as much, and I'd rather start training my team to handle much more of what's happening. I'd rather just be involved in new business acquisition and strategy and let the team really handle all the stuff, like the actual implementation. And then I'd like to spend more of my time doing kind of what we're doing right here, podcasting, creating content, creating video blogs, writing. I have a book that I'm writing that I'm way behind on, but I'm super excited about it. And I'd like to do stuff like that. More speaking, more content creation, more writing.
That's kind of where I thought, right? So it would seem to me that your personality and such is that, and you said this early on, tongue in cheek, but there's probably some truth behind it, is that, you have this desire to be upfront, not in a negative way, not in a selfish way. I don't mean it like that, but like, you want to be upfront. And when you run a company, sometimes you get so bogged down with it, you can never really be out doing the things you want to do. And if you're in a position, yep, to still make a living or even take a cut and make it up doing other things, then you've created that win-win situation for yourself. And I kind of think it fits your personality, right? You've been doing something now for almost 7 years, and it's probably time for you mentally to start thinking about that switch to whatever that's going to be, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm not saying you're closing your business tomorrow. Like, I'm not saying that either.
Yeah. And I don't want to, you know, I think what my business stands for is important in the world. I'm not saying that to be like lofty in my claims of things, but I think there are a lot of companies out there that are quote unquote doing social media. And we're not just like a social media marketing agency. The goal of my company is really to change the relationship that businesses have with their customers, the relationship they have with their employees, and the relationship that they have with the world, how they interact, how they change their products and services to meet the market, how they understand what's happening in the world and their industry. And, you know, all of those sort of things is really what I got into this business for. I want to leverage the power of social to make a change in the way that businesses run for the better. So I believe that my company is a necessity in that. Now, granted, I could probably go out and do it myself as an individual, you know, Jeff Gibbard Inc. speaking, blah, 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 blah. But I like having an agency. I like the agency model. I like working with a lot of different types of clients. The issue that I have is that I have a particular set of skills, and I need to better equip myself with a team around me that can fill in the gaps, kind of alluding to what we were talking earlier. And I think the more that I'm able to put myself out there and be front and center and let the team actually do the work, which I think they're going to be better equipped to do once they understand the methodologies and the mindset behind it, then I think we can actually still make an impact with the agency and allows me to kind of de-emphasize myself in the company.
Well, and sometimes, I mean, to be honest, we as individuals could be one of the thorns in the side of the wheel that's causing it to get flat. So my point is that there might be people that come in and backfill you that have different ideas that take the company in a greater, more impactful direction. And I'm not saying you hold it back or whatever, but we get in our own ways. And so like the hardest thing to do is that this is your baby. You've spent 7 years building this. Like, how do you decouple yourself from just letting people kind of do their job, I guess, you know? And I think that would be so hard to do on the whole. I don't know how well I would do with that. So what I want to do is quickly do my fast five. And then I want to talk to you a little bit about kind of random, but you know, this whole podcast has been a little bit random, is I want to talk to you a little bit about just your thoughts around the podcast industry. As someone who's in social media, and you see how it's, I think podcast is definitely the next medium. And it's growing quickly. But so let's quickly do fast five. Are you ready to do fast five?
Hell yeah.
Sweet. Question one, first job ever.
I worked at a pizza shop.
And what did you learn from that?
That I hate mopping floors. That I am born for management.
Yes. So did you delegate that to somebody else then?
I was not aware that one could do such a thing at that point, but I did like the free pizza that I got.
And how old were you then?
I was like 16, I think.
All right, excellent. Question two.
That's, I mean, it's the first like job sure. I can think of.
Yeah, sure. Okay, question two. What advice, this would be interesting because you're not too far removed, what advice would you give your 22-year-old self?
Start now. Don't worry.
Say that again.
Yeah. Start now. Don't worry. So, but like real quick on it is just that it's way easier to struggle in your early 20s. Like just go after it. You're not going to be homeless. Like you have friends, people like you, you'll be able to pick yourself back up, but just go fucking do it.
Yeah.
Like, don't wait. Don't wait till you have the skills or like till you're old. No, just start now, because every bit of effort you put in is like an annuity to the later self. And had I started everything earlier, I probably would tell myself the code also, like learn code.
Yeah. But you know what though? I think that's interesting because I think that all of the people I interview, their life's a culmination of their past. And you know, for me, the most interesting thing is to see all the different choices they've made. I interviewed a guy last night who was an actor, a producer, a teacher, and now an entrepreneur, right? Like, and a producer for like 15, 20 years, a teacher for 10 years. And now he's an entrepreneur and he has a company for the last 4 years that's, you know, he sells products all over the world. And I just think to myself, like, him being an actor and a producer taught him how to be in front of people, how to manage processes in terms of money and deals, teacher teaches you how to talk to people and educate in a simple forum. And then now he's an entrepreneur. Like, is this, so for me, like your term, like just start now, to me, it's like just start failing, like just start something and you may fail, but that's one piece of the block that builds you as a human being as you move forward.
Yeah. I completely agree with that. I think everything that I did contributed to who I am today, and they're all just perfect. The experience I have is perfect for who I am right now, obviously, because it couldn't be any other way. But I would say that I think I was held back a little bit by some fear along the way of like what might happen if, and I think that the way I think about it now is like, it's going to be fine. Like that's generally how my mind does. It's going to be fine. Just do it. Mm-hmm. So that's, I wish I just, I adopted that a little earlier.
That makes sense. I mean, I think fear stops many, many people. So question three is my favorite question. So don't disappoint me. What animal best represents your management style?
My management style? Oh
yes.
God, hold on. I would say a 6-year-old dog.
Okay. I like the specificity of it because you gave me age.
Yeah. Yeah. So like if I said dog, you know, a 15-year-old dog is different than a puppy, which is different than, so it's a middle-aged dog, and a middle-aged dog is lovable and, you know, they're always there for you and everything, but sometimes they just kind of want to go and like curl up by themselves and like be left alone. So I think that's kind of me. Like I mostly am there for my people at all times. And I am like, I think I'm very positive and inspiring, and I try to push them to be their best, which, you know, I don't think there's an animal that pushes people to be their best, but you know, I'm there. But then there's other times where I'm just kind of like, okay, everybody just leave me alone. I need to go curl up on my pillow and be left alone for a little bit so I can decompress.
So is that the same at home? Like because we all have a public private self, right? So for me, I do some podcasts, I go speak. I'm actually kind of exhausted afterwards because I put so much energy into it and so much like, so I need time by myself.
Yeah. I'd say at home, I'm more of a puppy.
Okay.
So like, I think I have a little bit more energy and, you know, kind of carefree excitement at home. Like when it's just me and my girlfriend hanging out, like we laugh a lot, we go out and we do like fun things, and then like we play hard and then we just pass out. So it's more like what a puppy would be like. There's less, you know, thoughtfulness. Like if you look at a puppy's face and you look at a 6-year-old dog's face, the six-year-old dog, you look behind their eyes and they're like, you're thinking of something. I can see it. And like, I think, you know, at work, that's me. I'm always thinking about something. But at home, when I give myself that opportunity to really unplug and disconnect and hang out, I'm just carefree. I'm like, let's go and just have fun. Let's go eat some sushi.
That's awesome. All right. Question. I didn't ask you this. Do you have any kids?
I do not have any kids yet, but okay. We have already planned the two that we will have one day, and we've already named them.
Best
laid plans, right?
so many comments that I'll refrain from. All right. So I'm just teasing. So question four, it's your funeral. What are people saying about Jeff?
I think people would say he was funny. He always had a smile on his face. He was a simultaneous combination of humble and cocky, but in a non-threatening way. And he did everything he did all in with passion.
Awesome. Awesome. All right. Final question. In your, you know, in your gut response, do you think social media is oversaturated now and less impactful than it was 5 years ago? And I'll give you a second. I only ask that question because humans, we start to tune things out.
I think, oh God, it's like such a complex question. Cause as like somebody who studies this space daily, my gut says both yes and no. And partly because I think that if you ask people, they would say yes, but the reality is no. I think people want to believe that it doesn't matter to them or that it doesn't impact them or that, you know, they're so bored of it. but statistics would say otherwise in terms of their usage and the impact of how they're using it. I think it's an interesting question because I think subjectively, it's past its prime. It's oversaturated. You know, we're all on the decline and it's just boring now. But objectively, I think no. I think there's obvious trends to show that people are shifting their attention to these mobile devices, and the primary media that are coming through it are through social type channels, social type media, podcasts, videos, news feeds, Snapchat videos, Instagram stories, all of those sort of things are happening. And I don't think we see them as the novelty that they once were. They're commonplace, they're communication channels. So I think it's not that they've grown stale or that they're less effective or that it's too noisy. It's just that I think we've become more accustomed to them being there, so we don't think about them as much. Like, it's like, is the phone over the hill? You know, has it jumped the shark? No. If you need to call someone, you just use it. You don't think about it. But it's there, sitting in your pocket. You can easily do it.
So that's actually a really good point. So to me, it would almost seem like certain mediums are in the mature phase. And then whatever the new it social media is kind of an introduction growth phase. But it would seem to me like Facebook is like in a mature phase.
Oh, undoubtedly. It's 100, not 100% mature, but it relative to the other networks, that is the one that's our Google. In social, Facebook is our Google. So like search, it's Google. In social, it's Facebook. Facebook won. Nobody is going to dethrone them anytime soon. Anybody that thinks so is incorrect. And I'm willing to stake my career on that, that in the foreseeable future, unless they do some horrifically over the top shit, Facebook has won. They own a lot of the other big players. And I don't think anybody else is going to come and challenge that incumbent, because the moving power, the staying power, I guess, that people aren't going to just move their social graph elsewhere. It's just, I just don't see it happening. They won.
Thank you. So we're done with that.
My pleasure.
It's never fast. That's all right. It's a lame name, really. Social media is just fascinating because you just don't know where it's kind of going. And I think actually the point you made to me that really resonated was that it just is now. It's not like a fad. It just is. Right. So,
yep.
It's not this new, unique.
And honestly,
thing.
I wish more people would take that approach in business about it. Like what I've said for a while is that people ask me all the time about Twitter strategies and shit. And generally what I say is like, I don't think about Twitter. Like for myself and how I use social media, I don't think about it. I don't go through like these mass mental gymnastics to try and figure out like, oh, what time of day should I post? It's just in my pocket and I use it to share and document my life. And I do that as a way of connecting with others and opening up opportunities for conversation and meeting people around like mind and topics. And so it's just in my pocket. I don't think about it in the sense I'm like, oh, it's Wednesday at 1 o'clock. I really need to be. No, I just use different tools to make sure that it runs a particular way. And while that I may not have like sat down and like really deeply thought that out, you know, at some point, I guess I gave it some pause, but ultimately it just sits in my pocket. And if more businesses were just like, oh, we just have these communication channels now, what should we do? And then they just start documenting and thinking about what's actually interesting about them, they'd be better at social media.
Yeah. You know, I actually, you know, I think like brand Facebook pages are kind of a joke unless you're a big player. Like I just don't see the benefit of LinkedIn business pages unless you're a big player. But if you're a smaller company, no one's going to LinkedIn to look for your business page. They're going to find someone they want to chat with or connect with. Facebook, it's so saturated with noise that unless you are the Cokes of the world, people just aren't going to follow you 9 times out of 10. Now, I also have total resentment when I see someone who has you probably have 10,000 followers, but like someone who has 10,000 followers on something, I feel like I'm pretty sure they bought those. Unless you are, you know, like it's so easy to do, right? So how often?
It's also a first mover advantage. Yeah. I mean, but at the same time, like, doesn't it also, aren't you immediately struck with a little bit of social proof when you see, you know, reviews for a product on Amazon and it's got, you know, 1,000 reviews and it's got 900 5-star reviews. You don't know if those 900 people are real or not, but like you immediately assume like, oh, well, I guess it's a good product. In the same way, if you see somebody has 100,000 followers, you're like, oh, wow, well, you know, if you're in the industry, you might assume, well, how did they get them? You're looking at the ratio. You're looking at, the, you know, their most recent followers. You're seeing, you know, how many of them have, you know, follow for follow in their bio. So, you know, you start thinking about those. But the average person doesn't think at that level. I think the average person doesn't think much about social media at all. They don't analyze it. They don't think about those things. They just see, oh, they have 100,000 followers. That means that they're important. I'm going to follow them. That's generally how it works, I think.
I guess I'm a bit more skeptical.
Like, I have a Twitter verified badge. I don't know how the hell I got the little blue check mark, but I did. And that means something to people. But I'm just Jeff in Philadelphia doing my thing, you know?
That's awesome. All right. So, just one more quick topic and then we'll hop off. You've been awesome with your time. Just, you know, you and I both are now in the podcast game, doing the podcast, you know, with this implosion of podcasts, and it really is explosion of podcasts. And, you know, you can't put on a podcast without hearing about three other podcasts. Like, how do you think you stand out? Right. Like, how do you make the unique statement? Obviously content's a big part of it, but what else? Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a couple things about the podcast game right now. So for one, it's super hot at the moment, and that makes it super competitive. So, like, for instance, last night our show hit number 4 on Overcast, which we were like, what? And that was crazy to us. But, like, we're nowhere to be found on iTunes, and we're nowhere to be found on Stitcher yet, which is fine. We're still early in, and we're going to keep after it. But I think it's a very competitive space, and you know, there are some players in it that have kind of a first mover advantage. Like, if NPR puts out a podcast, it's probably going to shoot to the top of the charts. If Tim Ferriss does anything, John Lee Dumas does anything, if Pat Flynn does anything, like, they're going to be on the charts because people know them. They're already known. So I think the competitive landscape is particularly challenging. So I think here's where the opportunity is. You know, people are like, interview shows are dead. Everybody's doing them. I think that's stupid. I don't think that's true at all. I think there's no such thing as, oh, that's been done a lot, so you can't do it. Because you can always rethink how you do it. So, for instance, you have long-form conversations with people that are just conversations, interesting conversations with people who are successful or leaders in their field, and you pick their brains about stuff, and that's your format. I interview people about people in technology. We recently came up with an idea about interviewing podcasters, specifically only interviewing podcasters. And the code name for the show is The Other Side. So it's literally just putting podcasters on the other side of the mic. So I guess my point is, you look at something like Serial, or you look at, you know, there's a number of different shows that are rethinking the format of the show. So you can even take something like an interview show, or you can take the format like podcasting and use it to tell stories over the course of a quote unquote season. And you're kind of reinventing, it's just radio. Yeah. So we have a lot of opportunities here. And I think what it comes down to is that if you're doing an interview show, it's about what you choose to interview people about, what your angle is, mm-hmm. and the host. So you can't replicate a host, right? So that, to me, nothing will ever replicate 6 pixels of separation, because Mitch Joel, he's the only person I know that can interview in exactly that way. And to me, it's the best in the business. Mm-hmm. Not everybody feels that way. You know, some people don't even know that it exists. To me, it's my favorite. But I think for the opportunity in the space, it's about carving out your unique niche. Because if you're just going to go on, and we talked about this earlier, and just interview anybody about anything, then your show doesn't really have a point. Yeah. You know, Joe Rogan can do, because he's fucking Joe Rogan and his show is amazing. But a lot of people can't get away with that. So I think now, because it's so competitive, you have to do something that makes you different. So if you're going to start an interview podcast, try and pick something that's super niche. I only talk to farmers who live in the United States and who are, you know, I don't know, using non-GMO seeds. Okay, that's who you interview. Cool. That's a show about that.
But, you know, that's an interesting point, because in September, I changed the name of my podcast. And so before September, it was called Brave Endurance Wellness Podcast. And I was just interviewing people in the health and wellness, corporate health and wellness space. Like, that was it. And my numbers are doing quite well for that particular space. And as soon as I changed the name, man, did I get kicked in the nuts. Like, it was a hard kick. I lost half of my listenership because it wasn't content specific to them. You know, and the style, by the way, is the exact same as now. The context was just different. So, but that was a,
I'll tell you, sorry, I was going to say, just to that point, you had a show name that spoke to a very specific thing. You know what I think is the best show name I've ever heard? Smart Passive Income Podcast. It's like the smartest one I've ever heard, because it is like, who doesn't want to subscribe to that?
Yeah.
it's perfect. So I think, you know, the executive after hours, I think it's a cool idea, because it's like you're hanging out with executives after hours. You're just chatting over a bourbon, whatever. But the previous one was like, it spoke to a very specific audience.
No, it did. And so it was a strategic choice for me, because I wanted to broaden my audience. And essentially then I have to look at different channels of distribution, which has happened with C-Suite Radio as well for myself, and a couple other channels that I'm working on at the same time. But the other thing about podcasting is it's unless you're a famous person, right? Like, it's the long game.
Mm-hmm.
And the two more comments on this, and I have my final question, and I'll let you go. Is I think Serial. I think that's the evolution of podcasting. I mean, you're gonna have your staple once a week, twice a week shows, but I think those short 10-episode, 12-episode shows, I think that's where more and more, I think podcasting is going. Because for a listener who's not familiar with podcasts, there's a beginning, middle, and end to the process. And people need closure. And for a lot of us, we're an open-ended podcast. It just goes on for infinite, right? So Serial really set.
There's also no urgency.
Correct. And so, well, there's not in podcasting either. But like if there's a 10-episode series, you get pulled into it, you know. Though I was grossly let down by Serial.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is what I'm saying is, if it's ongoing, then there's no urgency to listen to any one particular episode. But if you have a 10-episode season, then every episode matters, and you want to listen to every episode if you like the first one.
Whereas you might like any
one of your episodes, you may not care about listening to episode 248. Whereas, you know, if you have 10 episodes, there you go.
And I think that was my point. So that even if – yeah. So, and the other point I'm going to make is that I actually think because, you know, we produce and – do our podcast mostly for the US, that there is a much bigger market in the US. I mean, in the Middle East, they're probably 7 to 10 years behind us in podcasting. I ask my students, not one person knows what it is. And the opportunity for growth isn't going to be in the US, it's going to be internationally. And creating podcast networks internationally in certain markets, that's the growth. If you're someone who's like trying to set up frameworks and business models, that's the growth, because, mm-hmm. you know, as I can't remember the total volume. I don't know. Do you know the total volume of advertising they're predicting this year for podcasts? It's a billion mark, but I can't remember what it is. Do you remember?
Yeah, I have no idea. I wish I did know, because I would love sponsors if you're listening.
Yes. Right. I know. And I think they come, and I think the C-Suite Network will help you and I in that capacity at some point as well. So, all right, final question, sir. For you, your life, and also I need to note that I didn't ask you anything about your ex-wife, so I usually would go down that path, but I'll leave that one out. For you and in your current life, how do you define happiness?
I mean, for me, it's if I can pay my bills, move forward towards the things that I want to do in life, and have a reasonable amount of freedom. I think I'm just kind of a happy person. To me, happiness is a choice. It's something that originates inside of you by how you look at the world. But, you know, external events can impact that perspective. So, you know, when you have too much debt, that can feel kind of crushing and leads to non-happiness. If you can't afford to do the things that you want to do in your life, that can lead to non-happiness. So to a certain extent, money is a component of it, because it gives you the freedom to do what you want. Mm-hmm. But on the other side of it, I think it's also about there are aspects of your life that will lead you to be either happier or not happy. I find that every minute that I spend with my girlfriend, I am happy. She is just a delight to be around. So to me, that's a part of it. The relationship I've chosen to be in makes me very happy. The job that I have, the fact that I can work from home today and have sweatpants on, is fantastic. And that's part of happiness to me. I don't have to get up and go to some office and have somebody tell me what to do or what to wear. That's, to me, that's happiness. And that's the trade-off that I make. And other people are happier that they just get a regular paycheck. So you make trade-offs, but to me, happiness is about having the freedom and the the balls to live the life that you want.
Thank you, Jeff Gibbard. Thank you for your time, energy, and willingness to sit down with me on Executive After Hours. Have a fantastic week.
Thanks, man. Appreciate you having me on.